Jacksonville? Listen local.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. I'm your host, Jason Dolt. Thank you so much for being here with me this evening. You know, the second annual Borscht Belt Festival starts tomorrow in Ellenville, goes through this weekend. We're going to find out all about what's in store this year. They say it's going to be bigger and better. We'll go through the details with Andrew Jacobs, one of the festival's organizers, coming up in the second half of the program. But first up, it's time for the latest news in our area, and for that we turn to the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau head, Philip Pantuso. Philip, thank you for joining us once again from the Times Union. How are you doing?
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good, good. So let's start by following up on a story that we've been, you know, following for a while now, which is this whole congestion pricing situation. Is there still no sign from Governor Hochul of when this issue will be addressed?
Still no sign of when this issue will be addressed, but there was some news today in the form of two lawsuits that seek to reverse Hochul's decision and force the state to implement the toll. So both of these lawsuits were filed by environmental groups at the head. One of them was filed by the Sierra Club alongside the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance and a public transit advocacy group called Riders Alliance. The other was brought by the City Club of New York, which is a government transparency group. And both of these lawsuits, like I said, are seeking the same ends, which is to force the state to implement the congestion pricing program. But they are advancing different arguments for why legally the state is obligated to do that. And I can sort of talk through the two different legal strategies here.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, so the lawsuit that was filed by the environmental groups and the Transit Advocacy Alliance build their case on two parts of state law that they argue preclude Hochul's decision. One is the one that everybody already knows about. It's the 2019 Climate Act, which became law actually the same year that New York State lawmakers approved legislation that allowed the creation of the congestion pricing program. The Climate Act, you know, as everybody probably knows, set forth mandates for reducing emissions across the state, ending with an 85% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2050. Of course, the state is nowhere close to meeting or nowhere close to being on track to meeting that at the moment. And this lawsuit argues basically that the congestion pricing program or the decision to delay it violates the requirement of the Climate Act, which is to reduce emissions. And there were several studies done on similar congestion pricing programs in places like London and Stockholm that showed pretty drastic reductions in carbon emissions once those congestion tolls went into place. And that was part of the argument that many, including Governor Hochul herself, made in advocating for the passage of this program in the first place. The lawsuit also invokes a secondary piece of state law, which is an amendment to the state constitution passed in 2021 that created a new legal right to clean air, water, and a healthful environment. And the lawsuit basically says the same thing that it said about the Climate Act, that the decision to delay the congestion pricing program violates this new constitutional right for New Yorkers to have clean air, clean water, and a healthful environment. So that is the first lawsuit. The other lawsuit, this is the one that's filed by the Government Transparency Group, perhaps unsurprisingly takes a more kind of inside baseball, wonky, like good government tack. It argues that the law that was passed 5 years ago that allowed the state to create the congestion pricing program doesn't actually give Hochul the power to intervene in its implementation. So that law was called the Traffic Mobility Act. And one of the things it did is it delegated the responsibility of creating and implementing the program to an agency called the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, which manages tolls and bridges in New York City. Part of what took so long is that the plan needed approval from the federal government, which had to take on this, you know, pretty lengthy environmental assessment, but it has since given it the thumbs up on that. Hochul has said that implementing the program also requires sign-off from the State Department of Transportation, and that's with the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which oversees all the public transit in New York City, also says. Jano Lieber, who's the head of the MTA, said back in June that they can't just implement congestion pricing without the New York State DOT sign-off. But that does not really seem to be what the law that created or allowed the creation of the congestion pricing program actually says. And that's what the law, that's what the second lawsuit argues. Basically, it says that Hochul and the state violated that law because the authority to implement the program lies solely with the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. So, you know, we will see. The governor gave our Dan Clark, who's a Capitol correspondent for us, a pretty snarky response to these lawsuits. They said, a spokesman for the government said, get in line, that there are now 11 separate congestion pricing lawsuits filed by groups trying to weaponize the judicial system to score political points. Although the spokesman neglected to mention that the 9 previous lawsuits all sought to block the program, which, you know, we've talked about previously. These are the first 2 that seek to force the program to go into place. So, you know, a pretty critical distinction there.
Are any of those earlier 9 lawsuits still in play?
I mean, they're technically just all like pending or stayed right now because the program isn't dead. You know, the language Hochul used when she paused this was that it was an indefinite pause. And, you know, she said that it was because she was concerned. She'd heard from, like, you know, constituents in Midtown who either have to drive in to work, maybe from commuter districts, or who own businesses in Midtown. She had heard that there was some kind of concern about the lack of traffic, which is, you know, true, probably. Like, the point of, and this is another point that the second lawsuit makes, the point of the congestion toll is to limit the number of people who drive in to Midtown. The reason that they're doing that is to limit emissions, limit gridlock, and also, crucially, to raise, you know, $1 billion for the MTA, which really badly needs it, which will improve, you know, the ability of all the subway trains in the city and also the commuter rails, the Metro North and Long Island Railroad, to function better. So, and, you know, it's just worth reiterating that Hochul was a big proponent of this program until all of a sudden she wasn't, including making the argument that, you know, we need to limit the amount of cars driving into Manhattan. So, you know, to circle back to a direct answer to your question, those lawsuits are still all pending because the program isn't officially dead. You know, there's a lot of sort of behind the scenes scuttlebutt at what why Hochul really put a quote unquote pause on this is, because it was turning into a negative issue for vulnerable Democrats, downstate and in Long Island. And, you know, maybe we'll see a different outcome after November's election. That's where we're at right now.
And out of these 2 lawsuits that are essentially trying to get the congestion pricing going, I mean, I don't know what it says about me and, you know, my lack of legal knowledge, that out of those 2 lawsuits, the wonkier inside baseball one seems to be a bit stronger than me. That first one, you know, basically suing on the grounds of the state's climate plan, I mean, which, you know, it is law. I mean, if that succeeds, that's an interesting precedent, because there's a number of other things you could sue about to try to make sure that New York upholds those goals.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, really interesting point. You're right. The second lawsuit is a much more kind of black and white, you know, can probably be decided on a close textual reading of the law itself that enabled the congestion pricing. That second one would be, it's more along the lines of almost like advocacy, like an advocacy litigation or something like that. You know, it reminds me of the lawsuit back in the 60s that stopped the development of a power plant on Storm King Mountain that set the precedent for, like a whole half a century's worth of environmental litigation to protect overdevelopment and overextraction of natural resources, mostly because of how that would affect local communities. This would be kind of like a state version of that. And, you know, I'm no legal expert either, so I'm not sure if this is totally true, but I can't think of one off the top of my head, like a successful legal challenge to either block or, in this case, enforce a big infrastructure program on the basis of whether it violates the Climate Act and the constitutional right to clean air.
Okay, and moving on to other news, you know, we know that road work is starting on some local bridges in our area, and I know that this is part of like a bigger picture of the need for that, but you have more reporting about really how dire the need is for bridges and infrastructure across our region. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, speaking of infrastructure, a report out today from the state controller's office looked at the state of local bridges across New York. So local bridges are basically bridges that aren't owned by the federal government or New York State. They're owned by counties, cities, or towns. And there are about 9,000 of them across the state. And about 10% of those bridges were found to be in poor condition in 2023. And the way that these bridges are ranked is there's a kind of nine, I won't get too into the weeds here, but there's basically like a 9-point scale based on their capacity to carry vehicular loads. And bridges that score 4 or below trigger a poor condition label. So 10% is quite high. That is actually a slight improvement over the 12% in 2017, which was the last time this type of comprehensive review of local bridges was undertaken. But it does get worse, as you kind of alluded to, for our area. The region of New York that ranked worst in terms of like the highest percentage of its bridges were found to be in poor condition is the Mid-Hudson region, which, you know, it was basically the Mid-Hudson Valley down to also Westchester and Rockland and then out to Sullivan and Delaware counties as well. In the Mid-Hudson region, 13% of the bridges were found to be in poor condition last year. And in Ulster County specifically, where I'm speaking to you from, it had more bridges in poor condition than any other county in New York State, 63 overall, which is 25% of all the bridges in the county. Bad news, not really what you want. This is happening, really despite a lot of funding that has been allocated. There was a bridge restoration program in the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of 2021 that allocated $2 billion to New York alone to be used for state, local, and tribal bridge improvement projects, which is why we're seeing so many of those happening, you know, over the past like 2 or 3 years or so. Not just local bridges. Like, you mentioned work began this week on a nearly $18 million bridge rehabilitation project in Calicoon. Also this week, a $24 million rehabilitation project began for a bridge that is going to be fully replaced over the next 2.5 years in Esopus. This is a throughway bridge, so it doesn't quite fall under the quote unquote local bridges category, but it just goes to show that while this problem is bad on the local level, it's bad on the state level too. In the state announcement for the replacement of the thruway bridge, the governor's office noted that 75% of thruway bridges are more than 60 years old.
Wow. All right. So, and it's interesting, I think, in what you said there, let me just make sure that I got that right, but that you know, this is the state that's overseeing these repairs or not overseeing them, as the case may be, if things are this bad. But now that repairs are being implemented, they're overseeing it. But there are some funds that are coming from the federal level, right?
Yeah. It's sort of happening on all kinds of levels. So certainly the most amount of money that has come in to address all infrastructure, but specifically bridges, since that's what we're talking about, over the past few years, is that $2 billion from the Federal Infrastructure and Jobs Act. The state can make money available as well for local bridge repair, but counties and municipalities are also supposed to take on some of this as well. And I thought it was interesting, in response to this report from the Comptroller's Office today, the Ulster County Comptroller, Marsh Gallagher, she issued a statement really kind of chastising the Ulster County, the rest of the Ulster County government for not prioritizing bridge maintenance in over the past few years. She wrote in her statement, "The high percentage of county-owned bridges in poor condition is not for lack of financial resources, but instead lack of prioritization." And she noted that the county has enjoyed greater than average revenues over the past few years from sales tax, from increasing tourism in the area, more people moving in, and the kind of once-in-a-generation infusions of federal funds like the American Rescue Plan funds. I think the point she's making is that this might be in some instances and with some bridges a financial problem, but it's also a problem of a lack of prioritization, and it's something we need to be thinking about more deeply.
And it's something that, again, local folks can think about as we, wait to cross the Calicoan Bridge is being repaired for the next couple of years. So it's part of that bigger picture. Next story up, you want to talk about this new exhibit at the Claremont State Historic Site in Columbia County? Can you tell me anything about I don't think I've heard of Claremont State Historic Site before.
Yeah, so this is a cool story. So the Claremont State Historic Site, Claremont is the name of a mansion that overlooks the Hudson River. It's just south of Germantown, southern Columbia County. And it was the family seat for many generations of the Livingston family. Livingston family, very prominent in the history of New York. Folks will know them for Livingston Manor, which, there's the town out in the Catskills called Livingston Manor. The original Livingston Manor was essentially all of Columbia and northern Dutchess County. It was farms and iron plantations and other sort of sites of economic activity. And it was really just one part of a wide kind of multinational empire that the Livingstons ran for several generations in the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s, which included notably many sugar plantations in Jamaica and other parts of the Caribbean. So it's been, the Livingstons were, Robert Livingston was one of the first chancellors of the state of New York. Another Robert Livingston was one of the five people in the room who kind of helped draft what would go on to become the Declaration of Independence, and he was one of the signers of that. So again, you can't really overstate how important that family lineage is. I mean, just look at all the things called Livingston in New York State. So it's been well known for a long time now that the family owned enslaved people, not only on their plantations in the Caribbean, but also in Livingston Manor in New York State. But there had been no formal acknowledgement of any Black Livingston descendants, which, to be clear, would mean essentially descendants that were the product of rape between the Livingstons and the enslaved people that they owned. But there has been there's a guy named Christopher Rabb, who is a state assemblyman in Pennsylvania, who has traced his lineage back to the Livingstons. This was sort of passed down to him through the years. First, his oral history. There's a lot of letters and other genealogical documentation, DNA evidence as well. And he sort of confirmed all of this stuff and presented it to the nonprofit group that stewards Claremont State Historic Site. They're called the Friends of Claremont. Back in 1996, they include many Livingston descendants. He gave this presentation at a family reunion, and it was sort of just crickets. And what he's really advocated for isn't any kind of payment or anything like that, but really just inclusion of this branch of the family in the official narrative of the site and kind of the stories that are told about the Livingstons. And he has kept working on it over the years. And a couple of years ago, one of the cousins reached out to him. This was, I think, in 2021 or maybe even in 2020. So it was sort of in the wake of, you know, kind of wider national reckoning with racism and sort of racial legacies in America. And she basically asked, like, how she could help. And she helped kind of connect him to more resources locally. And, you know, basically one thing led to another, and the state parks office got involved, and they've opened up this new exhibit that will be in place at Claremont for a year that essentially details what is known about this lineage, starting with the person who is the third great grandmother of Christopher Rabb, a woman named Christiana Taylor Livingston Williams, who was born in 1812 to Barbara Williams, who was a Black Jamaican woman enslaved by Philip Henry Livingston. And she was born in New York City. And that's kind of where this lineage began. So it's a pretty interesting, we have a really great feature up on our website right now that looks both at this exhibit, but also the wider effort that it kind of took to get here. And this kind of larger question of like public history and who gets to participate in the telling of it. So I highly recommend people check it out. It's a pretty cool story.
And that story and others are up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau head Philip Pantuso. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
You got it. Take care.
And let's move on now. This is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole, and the second annual Borscht Belt Festival starts tomorrow in Ellenville. It runs through the weekend, celebrating history and culture of the Jewish resort era in our region with food, music, comedy, storytelling, and this year they even have a street fair. Andrew Jacobs is one of the festival's organizers and the president of the Borscht Belt Museum's Board of Trustees. Tim Bruno spoke with him this morning on Radio Chatskill.
For those who don't know, the Borscht Belt was, you know, a huge vacation draw for millions of people, mostly from the city, but, you know, from all over the region. There was a huge ecosystem of comedy and entertainment that grew up alongside all those hotels. And so the stand-up comedy is a big focus of what we do at the museum because really that played a big role in the evolution of humor in America. So the festival sort of celebrates that legacy. It's not just about nostalgia looking back. It's also a lot of contemporary young comedians and other artists. So it's really, you know, it's really about sort of, you know, teaching people a little bit about that history, but also just celebrating this region's role as a really big incubator for comedy in America.
You're going to delve into, you know, the history of the Jewish Catskills and the influence and the impact that those families who flocked here for summer vacations had on the area, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of the museum's mission is, you know, sort of drawing a little bit of attention to the role that sort of Jews played in kind of the creation of modern comedy in America, you know, sort of from, you know, the shtetls of Eastern Europe to the Lower East Side and then sort of transferred up to the Catskills, where a lot of these comedians, all the famous ones we know and love, really got the, you know, got their start. So it's, you know, and especially now with the, you know, a lot of the sort of polarization, anti-Semitism, it's a really a good thing to sort of remind people the sort of how diversity is such an asset to this nation, and sort of the role that immigrants and groups like Jews played in kind of the development of culture, popular culture in America.
Let's talk about the festival lineup. What's kicking off on Friday?
Friday we have, unfortunately, it's all that, but we have a really cool dinner. We took a menu from the 1968 Waldemere Hotel in Loch Sheldrake, and we have a chef, Chef Josh Cohn, is reinterpreting that menu, and that unfortunately sold out. But we have, we've got Cousin Brucey, you know, the iconic disc jockey. He's giving a talk. We have an outdoor screening of Dirty Dancing. We have a really great musical, the Jackie Mason musical, which is written by his illegitimate daughter and her mother. Who had an affair with Jackie Mason, and wrote a very, very funny musical about sort of being scorned by Jackie Mason as she was growing up two blocks away from him. We have Rachel Feinstein, a very popular a rising comic, so much, and, you know, 50 food vendors. So there's a lot going on.
One thing that also caught my eye was someone we've spoken to before. He's your archivist, Alan Frischman, and it's a private tour of his home, which is chock a block with all the ephemera saved from that era.
Yeah, so those who don't know Alan, he's a real national Sullivan County national treasure. He was previously a building inspector for the town of Fallsburg. He rescued a lot of stuff from the hotels before they were demolished. He's also the one issuing the demolition order, but then he would go in and save stuff before the wrecking ball came. And so his collection forms the kind of crux of the museum's collection. And that tour of his house, I don't want to call him a hoarder, but there's two brunch tours, unfortunately also sold out, but we'll be offering those regularly throughout the year because they're very, very popular. It includes a bagel and lox breakfast at his place.
Alan, if you're listening, we love you, but you know,
we love you.
It's a cry for help. Now, so there's so much going on. You mentioned the comedy. You mentioned some of the comedians. One of the folks that I was looking at was the festival kickoff with Julia Scotti, which is Saturday.
Yes, that's our first comedy show. She was the winner of America's Got Talent. Really great comedian. Yeah.
And then on Sunday, Mitzvah or Shanda, which is an interactive card game. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a goofy kind of comedy show. I haven't seen it, so I'm not going to give away anything else. But apparently it's very, very funny. Also, tickets are available for that. So yeah.
And then also Ed Sullivan County presents on Sunday.
Yeah, so that's kind of our throwback show. That includes a Joan Rivers impersonator, and there's about five comedians that are performing for that show. Very, very funny stuff. So I would, definitely come see that too.
And then it looks like you're taking over Ellenville for the festival. So what can folks expect in terms of the street festival that's going on?
So that's about three blocks long, and also down the Market Street. Yeah, I mean, there's live music. There's Babka Bake Off. Still time to enter that contest. Bring your babka, and you could be the winner of a very special prize. We have a Simon Says contest, and just all kinds of fun, goofy stuff happening along the street that day.
Food, all different kinds of stuff. There's more information on the website, borschtbeltfest.org. One quick question about parking. Folks can park anywhere on the streets of Ellenville?
Can park anywhere. Overflow parking is Ellenville High School.
All right. There's, again, more information at borschtbeltfest.org. Andrew Jacobs is one of the festival organizers, president of the Borscht Belt Museum Board of Trustees. We'll let you get back to the madness.
Yes, and the weather's going to be glorious, come on down.
Thank you. We'll see you there.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that's the second annual Borscht Belt Festival starting tomorrow, running through the weekend, and Tim Bruno was talking to Andrew Jacobs. Well, that's going to do it for the local edition tonight. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for listening. And do stay with us. I'm your host, Jason Dole. I will not be back tomorrow night. Patricio Rabai will be here for your Friday evening local edition. Coming up at 7, we've got Ramble Tamble kicking off our local music programming, including Connect the Dots at 9 and Virtual Soundscapes at 10. But before all of that, we're getting ready for the Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, NPR, WJFF, Jeffersonville.